So, specifically the blog and then we'll work into the wiki, because what we have with the blog and then the wiki is sort of step one and step two. The blog gets halfway there, the wiki takes it the whole hog. With the blog, which for those who aren't already aware, is simply short for weblog, or that's the derivation of the term, its number one feature is that it allows user input within particular parameters and methods. So the blog allows comments. I make a post, people can comment on that post, and multitudes of people can continue that conversation with or without me, whether I like it or not, immediately. And that's one of the other things about the blog. Whilst there can be, if you choose to have them, filtration processes on the blog, the traditional notion of the blog is if I make a comment, it's there straight away. You didn't have that experience commenting on the War Memorial site. It had to be filtered. And that's fundamentally different to our notion of a text. It's a step beyond the passive, which isn't just about being proactive necessarily or interacting. I hate interactivity. That's a crap word too. We hear it all the time here at the museum. Just because I pushed a button doesn't mean I had a better experience. You know, and I live and breathe technology. I've got more gadgets than I can possibly know what to do with. But I'm a big believer in that. Just because I pushed the button doesn't mean I learnt or engaged any more intuitively or innately with something. It can be, but it's not unto itself the right way. Which relates back to what the gentleman was saying in the copyright criminals film. He says, is the colour red creative? Is an interactive in a museum a better experience? If it's a good one. So we have those same ideas here. So what the blog really is, as a step beyond the passive, it's about ownership, of owning an experience. I read a book, I don't own that experience. I've engaged with that experience, I've had that experience, but I don't own it. If I could rewrite Jane Austen's Emma, where she gets run over by a train, then that would be my ownership of that story, because it's manipulated and I've been able to exert some part of how I feel about that author or that character into that text. So because a coarse example, but this notion of ownership becomes very, very important. It relates to very simple pedagogical and teaching ideas, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. The student arrives to an answer on their own accord, given the right parameters. They understand it. They own that knowledge far better than you just told them the answer. So this is not new, folks, but with the blog, it becomes an innate part of how it functions. It's about text expansion, and this is what I particularly like. I might write a blog entry that long. It's just the beginning. By the time that's had some comments and some feedbacks and I've added to it, the text has been expanded. So there's remix, there's reinterpretation, there's malleability, but there's an expansion of a text. The text constantly expanding. It's a little bit like the Earth, the universe after a big bang. That it has this innate and ever-going ability to expand. That changes our notion of textuality, of authorship, where it's a finite thing. However, the blog, as I said, is only one step removed. And because it still retains some elements of the closed system, the blog still has a primary author, which may be in the form of a moderator or the site's owner, and I use that in a fairly loose term. And whilst they can exert either greater or lesser degrees of control over the blog, the blog itself still has some remnants of the closed expert system in there. It's not to make it better or worse. We can just recognise that that's where it comes from. So here's some examples. Here's a very simple example. I have my own blog, which is essentially a blog of my PhD research, and that I continually add to as I read and find things. But I discovered this presentation done by somebody else. A lot of my research is on gaming. So I commented on this person who'd written this rather... Here it is. She'd made this rather wonderful presentation called 21st Century Folktales, about computer gaming and the expansion of myths in game environments. And so I made a link to it, and you'll see the post I've written there, Games and Narrative. Don't let the ugliness of this website divert you from the very interesting observations about game narrative. It's a bloody ugly website. It's just black with bold colour, and it scrolls forever, and you know, there's no negative space going on in this thing. So I made that comment, and I said it's a wonderful presentation. You can see it has a comment. The comment is from Kim, and it says, "Hey, sorry about the ugly design. It's my department's standard livery." You kind of get that. You kind of get used to it after a while. That's the author of the presentation. I don't know her, I've never met her, I never intended for her to read it. She did, and she left a comment. Not particularly insightful, didn't necessarily text expand my process, but what it does introduce is a very, very different notion for your digital native students to engage with the notion of who is going to hear me? Who can I speak to? How loud can my voice be? because if I pick up a novel, I can't talk to Jane Austen, I can't talk to T.S. Eliot. Even if it's an author that's still alive, the chances of that author seeing it, zero. On the blog, it might be 1,000 to 1, but that's a whole lot better than zero. And the potential for that to be seen on a wider scale is huge. Some blogs have, you know, attract millions of hits a day, and they come from nobodies who just started writing about stuff. So what it becomes is not necessarily about the actuality of what happens, that the author is always going to see your comments, and that opens up a whole new way of thinking about authorship. What it becomes about is the possibility. And so your digital native students are, by design, aware of that possibility, that what they put out there can be seen by anyone. And that's fundamentally different to the notion we might have, and I sit right on the cusp of digital native, digital immigrant, is this notion of who can hear me when I speak. That notion of speaking I'm going to come back to as well with some other theorists as we go along. Here's another one. This is a blog called Fresh and New. It's the blog of the Digital Media Services Department here at the Powerhouse Museum. And if you're interested in museums, digital media, teaching, education, learning, and cultural theory, you want to check out this blog. It's got some good stuff, but you'll see right at the top, ScreenSpeak presentation, Mike Jones. You can download my full presentation slides from there. And I almost set up a parameter on it which said, you can't download it till you leave a comment. But I didn't. I'll leave that up to you. This presentation I'm making today is not a closed expert system. It is not complete. So let this presentation evolve. Go there, download it. The website is just powersmuseum.com/DMS blog, which brings us to the wiki. If the blog is one step away, then the wiki takes us somewhere else. It's an open architecture of collaboration. The most important distinction between a blog and a wiki is that on a blog, it says, you know, Small Bites, a blog by Mike Jones. It says Fresh and New, a blog by Digital Media Services of Powerhouse Museum. On a wiki, there's no author. There's no named authors on something like Wikipedia. So it becomes completely an open architecture of collaboration. Multi-users, multi-authors, and amongst those multi-authors, no identifiable author, but the work itself. It has universal access to that authorship. I can read it, I can comment on it, I can modify it, and I can compose it. Just as a brief poll, who's used Wikipedia? Everyone's found it, and usually it's when you've Googled something else and found it there. And have you ever gone to Wikipedia and looked for something and there hasn't been an entry on it? And what's it say? Put one in. So this is the fundamental notion of what Wikipedia is a universal access to that notion of authorship. It is not a closed expert system where here are the facts, come and partake of those facts. It says, here's a body of knowledge, come and contribute. Proactive engagement. And that's fundamentally different to the closed expert system of education that has been so prevalent since the Industrial Revolution. I am the academic, I am the custodian of the knowledge, come and drink of the fountain, is a pretty dead notion. And particularly any teacher that's had to teach technology subjects, you've all got students who are kind of like, leaving you for dead. So what do? You can fight it if you want, knock yourself out. Or you embrace what they know into the room, and you learn, and they learn, and everybody learns. And that's really where Wikipedia is at. That's really where the notion of a wiki is at, is that nobody knows everything. Nobody can ever know everything. But we can collaborate and gather this knowledge together. It's not perfect, as we'll see in a moment, but it does have some very interesting traits to it. And again, really starts to question this notion of the author, as we traditionally understand them. There's no singular author in the Wikipedia. It has no identifiable author in the Wikipedia. It is collaborative, anonymous authorship. So what we have with Wikipedia in particular is a notion of peer review for everyone. We might look at something like the wiki and Wikipedia as the sort of key example of a wiki, although you can have wikis that aren't Wikipedia, and there are many, many of those. Is we might look at it and say, well, this is a pretty radical idea. This is very new. It's actually not really new. There's nothing new under the sun. It's just peer review. And the notion of peer review has existed as an academic process since the birth of formal education. Every science journal for the last 100 years is built on the notion of peer review. The science itself is built on peer review. Academic literary theory is built on peer review. I put forward an idea, and if lots of people agree, it will grow to the, it'll rise to the surface as a filtration process, and if lots of people disagree, it falls to the bottom as obscure theory. And this is how we get to Newton and laws of physics, not necessarily because they're 100 years from now going to be seen as right, but they've passed the test of peer review over time. Wikipedia is just peer review for everybody. And so to question Wikipedia as useful, to question its position as worthwhile or functional as an academic form, is actually to question the notion of peer review itself. We start questioning that, and whole pillars of our society are going to come crumbling down, because so much of what we understand about science and theory and literature and cultural studies is built on peer review. Now, there are differences, and you know, we'll get to those. Accuracy, usefulness, and relevance are arrived at through this process of filtration by peers. But of course, there are issues and concerns. So what are some of the issues and concerns with Wikipedia? Accuracy is invariably going to be one of the key concerns. Is it right? If anybody can write it and anybody can change it, how reliable can it be as accuracy? There have been famous cases. There have been cases of scientific entries in Wikipedia where there's been dispute over the two inventors of some particular process or chemical, and so one goes into Wikipedia and writes the other person out of history. It's effectively Egyptian pharaoh practice in the digital age. Quick, chip their name out, they were never here. There's nothing new under the sun. And so that happens, and that can happen, and there really isn't any formal safeguard for that, because the Wikipedia has no formal moderator. What it has is peer review, and it relies on that filtration process. As an example, and it's a simple example, and more certainly can be said about this, but the very well-respected journal Nature, the scientific journal, one of the sort of longest-standing scientific journals in the world, conducted a test of 42 selected science-related entries in Wikipedia and Encyclopedia Britannica. Encyclopedia Britannica had an average of 3 errors. Wikipedia had 4. That's pretty good going for something that is really, really openly peer-reviewed. Now, why is this? You know, any study can be questioned. Was it a leading question? All sorts of stats can be questioned. But what it does start to illustrate is that peer review is an effective process. It has a long history of being a very effective process. What we've now done with it is open it up further. We've opened up that notion of who can contribute, who can own the knowledge. And so what this becomes is not necessarily just a question of, is Wikipedia right? It could be argued that's not even relevant. What becomes relevant, particularly from an English narrative textual study, is about saying, well, is it right? What do you think? How might you change it? How can you interpret this? Let's do a cross study between Wikipedia and Encyclopedia Britannica with your students. Let's compare what Wikipedia says about Jane Austen's Emma with what some textbook says about Jane Austen's Emma. How might they be different, and why are they different? Because one's collaboratively put together and one isn't. So it's not really a debate about whether right or wrong. It's a tool just waiting to be embraced. It's a fantastic opportunity, I think, to really understand this notion of who says so, which I think is so fundamentally important to a critical literacy and to this to the English curriculum as it stands in New South Wales today. So the blog and the wiki are a challenge to these well-established ideas of closed text with an author and with content that is owned, that is intellectual property. They are not closed. They have no singular or even identifiable author. Content itself has no owner. And this is, as Lawrence Lessig said in the video, is about that transition from free culture to a culture of permission. The digital natives, and this is where we start to hit those hard points between where traditionally you guys come as digital immigrants with a traditional immigrant education yourself, one that comes from a closed expert system, into where your students are at. The digital natives continue to develop communication skills and knowledge in a techno-cultural environment where traditional notions of textual ownership may seem out of sync with the true working nature of the text they're engaging with on a daily basis. So whilst you're teaching the authority of this author, and this is what they wrote, and we can analyse it and question it and all those sorts of things, but here it is closed and finished, they're remixing their mate's song, re-editing it with the Bush and Blair speech, sending it via SMS to someone else. Oh, I'm going to change that a bit. I'm going to send it on. They're doing a process. They're engaging with a process that's fundamentally at odds with the system that you grew up on. That doesn't make one system better or worse. What it means is you have to understand where those students are at in terms of perhaps why they scratch their heads when you talk about a textbook? Why they shake their heads despondently when you pull out an encyclopedia to look up something and don't just go to the computer? They will shake their heads at you because you are showing your accent, as Mark Prensky says. You're displaying this thick accent. And what often happens with any new migrant to Australia that comes with a non-English speaking background, they invariably end up having much better grammar and speaking more correct, if that is a useful term, English, than the native, because they've had to learn it from an abstracted perspective. And that's kind of where you are. So whilst you may naturally know more about digital technology than your students, they probably don't think so, but you probably do, you still speak with an accent. Just as the new Arabic or Indian migrant to Australia will continue to speak with a thick accent despite having impeccable English. Accuracy and authority of any author can be called into question. And this is what critical literacy is about. This is why governments are so scared of it. Because what is the teaching of any subject of any kind about? Asking questions. That's all. That's what science is about. That's what English is about. It's about asking questions and arriving at the structures that allow us to form answers and then question those answers or compare answers. So what we have is this, the author being called into question is fundamental to where the Wikipedia and the blog are at. They don't hide it. They wear it on their sleeve. That's what they're there to, that's what they are there to be. That's what's meant to happen for their existence. More so in the context of unmediated and unofficially moderated text. Is this any worse than the intense filtering and mediation and bias that happens through official channels such as TV networks or publishing houses? Whilst we question the legitimacy or usefulness of a blog or a wiki, but we'll sit down and watch A Current Affair? Information via blog or wiki, whilst unregulated, doesn't hide its unregulated nature, nor does it openly masquerade as a definitive authority. It says everything's a work in progress. You got something, Dad, you disagree? Have your say. You can be heard. The very nature of blogs and wikis is to be questioned. And I think we need to teach that. The problems will happen with this new world order if we're approaching it with the old closed system, because we won't question it. And the blog and the wiki are only functional when they're questioned. Sadly, contemporary culture rarely engages with this kind of peer review. Indeed, it can be argued that our fearless leaders have a vested interest in having a populace that doesn't question authorship authority of text, else we might question their motives. It doesn't surprise me in the slightest that Mr. Howard would find such a strong objection to notions of teaching critical literacy and postmodernism and having websites as viable texts of study. It's not about whether they're good or bad, or is it quality and rubbish, as he described it. What an absurd term to use. Why? He doesn't want voters questioning and saying, you know what, you've used this Anzac Day line a few times. I'm starting to question your motives. Governments should fear their people. They won't fear them if they're not asking questions. So to bring this back to education, wikis and blogs in education, Mark Prensky, well worth looking up. There's his website, has written some great essays. Wonderful reading. What happens, unfortunately, with a lot of Mark's work is it's mistaken for everything we do in this classroom should be about computer games. That's not right. He's a teacher who thinks these four things are important. Dealing with change, producing engagement, mutual respect, and sharing success. And what he went looking for was a way to engage those four. And what he found was the computer game was one way. And 20 years from now, it might be something different. But for now, if you want to talk about what engages your students, it's computer games. Okay, if we can accept that and we need to deal with change, let's find a way to leverage what's powerful about that medium. So unfortunately, the naysayers of Mark Prensky's work often sort of hang on to this, oh, he's all about computer games, I think that's crap. What they're ignoring is he's actually about these four things. At the moment, it happens to be that computer gaming is a way into these four things. And as teachers, you should all want these four things. As a society, we should want these four things. Dealing with change, producing engagement, mutual respect, and sharing success. Reggio Emilia is another educational theorist that I really like, famous for setting up an art school in the hills of Italy. And he just has this really simple line, let the walls speak. And it's not a new thing. Teachers, particularly primary school, in my experience, embrace this more than high school. They put the stuff on the wall. In the same way your kid does a great painting with his finger and his tongue at kindergarten, you stick it on the fridge. Because you want to let the walls speak. You want to let the students feel that they have a voice and that it will be heard. What is a blog, a wiki, and the World Wide Web but the biggest billboard we can possibly imagine? And we get to expand on this idea of letting the walls speak, and I think that's really crucial, not just on a school education level, I think that's bigger on a social level. It's about having a voice. It's about having ownership. The other one I like, as I mentioned before, is Axel Bruns, his idea of the prod user. Your students aren't readers anymore. They're not viewers. They're not audiences. They're producers. They're prod users. They will make as readily as they will take. And they should be encouraged to do that. But this idea of the prod user, where anyone can edit, invokes that notion of ownership, of authorship, of having a voice and being heard. I think at this point, what's interesting or vital to understand is what wikis and blogs are not. And this is really crucial. They're not a replacement for the novel, the textbook, essay, or journal. Certain members of our government or social bodies would want to believe they are because that gives them a legitimate argument to have. But they're not. And no one with half a brain would suggest that they are. The television didn't replace the novel. It just added a whole new canon of media to understand. This whole the notion that one's better than the other is absurd. The printing press may have given us Shakespeare. It also gave us Hustler magazine, mm-hmm. Women's Day. Television may have given us Big Brother, God help us all, and A Current Affair. It also gave us Carnivale, Angels in America, NYPD Blue, for that matter. Great TV drama. It also gave us amazing documentaries. It gave us Four Corners. So it's not a replacement for these things. It's another way. They're not a better source of information either. And this is crucial. And this is where we have to look back, well, what are we teaching our students? If they rush into blogs and wikis without some sort of framework guidance, they will not question them. They will treat them as authoritative. And that's problematic. So the problem isn't necessarily the form, it's how we teach it. So we need to encourage, I think, in society as a whole, not only to question, but to not see information as innately better than anything else. That we need to take in and sift for ourselves. Heaven forbid we come to our own conclusions. They also don't diminish or belittle the place of the author. As I said before, I make a substantial part of my living as that authoritative closed system author. I'm not threatened by this. I shouldn't be threatened by this. Let the walls speak. Put the articles out there. This is the lesson the music industry is learning the hard way and slowly. I heard a speaker once who was a graphic designer for the music industry who gave this great analogy. He said, after the First World War, how many shipping companies got into airlines? None. Subsequently, half of them went bankrupt. Why? Because they thought of themselves as shipping companies, not transport companies. The music industry is in the same boat. They don't see themselves as music delivery companies. They see themselves as CD printing, selling companies. So the problem isn't that we've been given this technology that can do what they keep telling us not to do. Try telling a kid to not burn his mate's CD. It's absurd. I'm not going to ask you to dob yourself in, but I reckon there's probably less than 5 people in this room who haven't breached copyright burning a CD. And if you haven't, go do it tonight. It's not the technology that has to change. It's just a tool. You don't change the hammer because it doesn't build the house you want. What we have to change is the structure that drives it, the economic structure in the case of the music industry. So what happens here is it doesn't diminish or belittle the place of the author. The author just evolves. They evolved when the printing press happened. They will continue to evolve throughout history. This is just the next step. And what we have to do, come back to Prensky's four pillars, we have to be able to adapt to that change and continue to create a challenging environment. They're not a degradation of language. They're not a debasement of quality. I get frustrated with this notion of, the King's English, which we still haven't shaken off. This notion there's a right way to speak. You drag someone out of the 15th century and get them to listen to me, and I like to think I'm speaking fairly formally, at least acceptably for an adult public audience, and they would think I was just debased. So this notion of a degradation of language is absurd. What we should be teaching is appropriate language for the media that you're using. I hate the criticism of email and SMS language. It's absolutely 100% appropriate to the media. It's a vital, beautiful, succinct, crafted language of its own. It's not appropriate to write a letter to your parliamentarian in that speak. Of course not. That's what you've got to teach the students. The problem is not the technology. It's teaching a critical approach to that technology and know how and when to use it. Which, of course, leads us to the other half of that, what wikis and blogs are. What are they? Of course, Gauguin, where have we come from, what are we, and where are we going to? It is a new way of thinking, and more importantly, rethinking. And this is where I'm passionate about postmodernism. I'm passionate that we need to go through this postmodernity. We need to question everything that has come up in the past. We need to question who owns those stories, who tells those stories, and why they're there, because we cannot move forward until we do. It is a way to promote a more proactive engagement with texts. I imagine that I, as a high school student, spent more time in my English class in the hallway than in the classroom, that I might have found, you know, and I grew up to be a writer, but I would have found a better engagement if I'd been allowed to rewrite some of the stories that I was made to read. Why wasn't I allowed to write that Emma got run over by a train? That's my legitimate response to that story. I should be allowed to explore it, and I should be asked to justify why I feel that way. Instead, I was just told I couldn't. So it's about a different, more proactive engagement with text that ultimately can do nothing but lead to a better understanding. It's most importantly a way to promote ownership of learning and knowledge processes. I think it's important, and what we can take from these tools, and that's all the wiki and the blog are, they're just tools, they're just different hammers to make different houses, is the idea of owning learning. No, it's not something that's enforced on me by a closed expert system, it's something I'm a part of, and I own the process of my own learning. And it's a method for promoting true critical literacy. I mean, really engaging with an idea of, you know what, I'm not sure I believe that, and I'm going to just rethink that. How might someone else have thought about it? What about if I think about that from the point of being a woman, or an Indigenous person, or a migrant, or someone else whose voice is otherwise marginalised in that story? It questions our authority and our social structures, which I think always need to be questioned. It's a perfect means to compare and contrast ideas of truth. I love the idea of whose bloody truth. Whose truth are you talking about? Because I don't know your truth. It ain't mine. Who owns this meta-narrative? Who owns this process? What I think this gives us, and what I hope you would take away, is the idea of the tool. Is an approach to technology that is tool-like. It's just a hammer that I bang a nail in with. I'm far more interested in the nails that I get to bang in than the tool I get to bang them in with. And that's really where you've got to hit your students with these tools. The wiki and the blog is one way there. It becomes a questionable, problematic argument when you say, this is the new way, and it's the only way, and everything else is wrong, and nothing is ever that clear-cut. You shouldn't treat the wiki and blog like that. You shouldn't treat the web like that. They're just tools. And you may find they're very useful tools for having these sorts of engagements that I think are really valuable. Thank you very much.